This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03, Monday afternoon, April 22nd. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. A new wearable computer will feature two large earbuds augmented by artificial intelligence. We'll learn more in our next segment. But right now, buying a house in a community with good schools comes with a cost. Let's discuss the price of real estate and the quality of education with Rick Sharga, founder and CEO of the C.J. Patrick Company in Orange County, California. Rick, thank you for joining us today. And if you are a family and you are in the mode of looking for and buying a new house, the first question you ask yourself and your realtor when you are looking for a home is, how are the schools? And if you want a good school, even if it's a public school, you're going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, somewhere in the neighborhood of 75% of homeowners with a family or home buyers with a family, ask that very question first, Rob. What's the quality of the school district? And because of that, there's a lot of competition for properties that are within the bounds of those good schools. It's a very common historical factor, and it does tend to inflate the property values or the prices for those homes.
And that cuts pretty much across the entire country and no matter the location of the school district, because even though when you talk about big city public school districts like the Chicago Public Schools, where there's a great deal of debate about policy and equity and whether outcomes are evenly distributed across schools, I do know from my own personal experience that if there are higher or better performing schools in the Chicago Public School system, the houses inside that school's boundaries, not even just the district, the boundaries of the school, they sell for a premium as well.
Yeah, it's not unusual, Rob, for somebody to spend a 25 or even 50% more on a very similar house inside a good school district compared to what they would spend outside the bounds of that district. So it does become a factor when people are trying to budget for what they're going to be able to afford in their new home.
We're talking about the Good Schools Premium with Rick Sharga, founder and CEO of the C.J. Patrick Company in Orange County, California. Now, how has the kind of funky, for lack of a better word, housing market coming out of the COVID pandemic and the interest rate shock, are we still seeing that Good Schools Premium even at inflated prices?
Yeah, we are. It actually adds to the problem. It's exacerbated the situation. So home prices are up significantly over the last few years, and the home prices in those good school districts are up even more than properties across the board. So really difficult times, particularly for first-time buyers looking for a property in one of those better school districts.
Now, there are some, you have to do your homework, but at least one real estate agent I talked to when I was looking for a home several years ago was, you could find a house that may not necessarily be in that school's taxing district, but you're still inside this district's boundaries. So you could get the schools, but not necessarily take the property tax hit. Is that kind of one way to beat the system? But it's as the real estate agent told me, you really have to do your homework there.
Yeah, you save on the margins there. So your biggest price in your home purchase obviously is going to be your monthly mortgage, and those properties that are close to good schools tend to have the highest prices and therefore the highest mortgage payments. You can save a little bit on property taxes if you can manage to do that kind of homework and find a property that's in a good school district but outside of the higher tax area.
Rick Sharga, founder and CEO of the C.J. Patrick Company in Orange County, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, the latest development in AI-era hardware.
You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
A product expected to ship this winter is a wearable computer with capabilities that include using sounds from the real world within the custom-fit earbuds it comes equipped with. Let's learn more about it from Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for the news site Axios in San Francisco. Francisco. Ina, thank you for joining us today. And tell us about, is it IO1, this AI application for your ears? What does it look like and how does it work?
So it looks a little bit like those big ear piercings that some people get called gauges, but it's not a piercing. It is a earbud-like computer with a big circle where the computer lives and then a custom-fit earbud that goes in your ear. And the idea is that you'd wear this all day and you would let real-world sound through, maybe even a little bit improved. And then when you need the AI computer, it's right there on your ear.
And what does the AI do to enhance your listening experience as you wear this particular device through the streets of Chicago or San Francisco?
So as it was demonstrated at TED last week, what it would do is let you control. So there's a lot of things we could do to make the sound that we hear better, and this tries to do some of it. For example, if we were having this conversation not over a nice cellular connection, but instead at a crowded coffee house, there really is pretty simple to take the other sounds that we don't want to hear and have them blocked out. So that's one thing it could do before it even starts answering questions, is really help focus the sounds we want to hear and block out the ones we don't. Obviously, we have some of that today with noise-canceling headphones.
So it's probably not the use case that former Google engineers and the tech industry that they're looking for. They want this leading edge, cutting edge technology. They want it to be revolutionary. But the first application I could think is that it would make one heck of a hearing aid.
Yeah, and we're really seeing a blurring of the latest in earbud technology and what we used to think of as hearing aids. Already you can use a pair of Apple AirPod Pros and really use them to enhance your hearing. There's still a medical line, so there are still dedicated hearing aids, but that certainly is going to be one use for this kind of technology. But their idea is much broader, to have kind of an AI computer that's always there at the ready as well.
We're talking about AI wearables with Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios in San Francisco. Is this kind of where we are right now, is that there is so much promise and so much money to be made in artificial intelligence that we are going to be seeing just prototype after prototype after prototype as different engineers from different software companies try to take a swing at the ball and move it down and move the technology downfield in some meaningful way?
I think so, Rob. I think what you're seeing is an awareness that, wow, if we have all these chatbots and the interface is just a conversation, what would a different kind of computer look like? I asked Sam Altman last year, the CEO of OpenAI, about hardware, and he said, look, there's never been a new era of computing that didn't also have new kinds of hardware associated, and we'd be open to building it if we knew what it is. And I think lots of companies are trying to figure out what that might be.
And the road to the iPhone, or the road to Facebook, or the road to the personal computer, or the road to the iPod is littered with all sorts of applications or pieces of tech that didn't quite get off the ground. And I'm guessing, as far as AI is concerned, we're sifting through that right now.
We are, and it's much harder if you're a smaller company.
Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for the news site Axios in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, artificial intelligence takes on a greater role at Chicago's hometown airline.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Artificial intelligence is gaining traction at Chicago-based United Airlines. Let's get the latest from Joe Schwederman, Professor of Public Services and Director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul University in Chicago. Joe, thanks for joining us today. And you're an airline operations veteran, so let's talk about AI at United on two levels, starting with on the airline operations side. I mean, how much data flows through the operations side of things that passengers largely don't know about, and what can AI do to manage that flow of data to make the employees' jobs easier?
Yeah, it's really exciting. You think of an airline, it's like this giant clock where everything has to move a certain way. But every flight has different challenges. I mean, it'd be catering problems, fueling problems, maintenance problems. And you have to very quickly summarize operational issues, both for staff and pilots, and do it just tens of thousands of times per day. And so what AI is able to do is sort of cut through a lot of the difficulty of pulling out the most significant information. So example would be a pilot is taking off and he needs to make an announcement to passengers about what's unique about the flight. Are we going to be late? What's the weather at the other end? Where can you expect your baggage? All that can be handled with an AI program that used to take, you know, one system having to talk to each other.
And then one thing that really came out two summers ago after the airline system kind of melted down just over the crush of all the passengers returning to the skies, one common complaint by flight attendants was that they were delayed so long and then that would push them out of their service window and then they would spend the next 10 hours on hold with the airline operations center trying to get their next assignment. Is this a situation where AI could eliminate that call center or that need to be on hold for 10 hours to find out where you're going next?
You know, that was interesting about the news that's come out about United's big push. And they made no secret that ChatGPT was kind of a game changer for them when they saw what it could do. An example they're using, which is similar to your example, so many times when people call and want to speak to live agents because they want to talk about options. You know, my flight is late. I need to get close. I can't wait 6 hours. Where can I go? And it's hard to do that with sort of a button system, press two for option, you know, but AI actually can, you know, take text and sort of read the nuance of the questions and then send back options to people in a way much like a human being. And that's caused United actually to completely eliminate, you know, in its chat feature, the human interaction on the other end for most kind of inquiries. We're going to see that with flight crew issues as well, where every crew challenge has its own nuance. And we see Southwest really drop the ball by trying to be way too rigid and not collecting that feedback from the crew about unique needs they have. So AI is a big part of the answer.
And then very quickly, Joe, how well is this AI? How well will the AI be trained? Because there's already that notable Air Canada example where it made up a refund policy basically out of whole cloth, and the airline had to honor it because that's what the chatbot told the customer. So is that something that you have to teach the AI to just present the options that are there and not hallucinate one?
Well, that's exactly right. We did see, like with Southwest and the debacle they had a year and a half ago, that every new challenge, you know, something we haven't thought of before. And so if you think AI is going to handle every kind of customer complaint, you're probably dreaming. But I do think the airlines are really good at triaging, knowing those things that's always similar questions, labor intensive, but can be done with information. And, you know, a really good example of that is pilots have concerns about maintenance, they want to summarize to the crew or to the passengers how long it's likely going to take and what's the nature of the problem and how the pattern of repair is going to look. They can sort of be given that information dynamically and focus on what's most important, and that's doing the job.
Joe Schwederman, thanks for joining us today to talk about AI at United.
This is Chicago's news, traffic, and weather station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The search is on for a shooter after an off-duty Chicago police officer was killed in the Gage Park neighborhood on the southwest side over the weekend. Opening statements and first-day testimony have wrapped up at the Trump hush money trial in New York. New weight loss drugs are having an impact on food sales at restaurants. And at Stock Picker Monday, we'll get a couple of suggestions from an investing pro. WBBM Business, the markets are higher. The Dow is up 316 points, the NASDAQ is up 170, and the S&P 500 is up 49. 63 degrees right now in Chicago under mostly sunny skies, going up to 67 today. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. Chicago police are working to track down a suspect following the shooting death of an off-duty member of the department on the southwest side early yesterday. Officer Luis Huesca was heading home from his shift around 3 in the morning when he was shot and killed near 55th and Kedzie. This is Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling.
The officer was 30 years old, and in 2 days he would have been 31 years old. 6-year member of the department.
Mayor Johnson says the city is deeply mourning the officer's death, adding no family or community should ever have to suffer such pain. Opening statements are in the books at the historic Trump hush money trial in New York. Former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker then took the stand before the session ended for the day. This is CBS News correspondent and senior political analyst John Dickerson.
Inside the courtroom, fairness is supposed to rule. Truths are supposed to be important. A certain set of traditions and laws are supposed to rule. Outside in the hurricane, that's all up for grabs these days.
The former president has denied having a sexual encounter with adult film entertainer Stormy Daniels, and his lawyers argue that payments made to lawyer Michael Cohen were legitimate legal expenses. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Stocks are trading higher. Let's see what's elevating markets with Jack Ablin, Chief Investment Officer, Crescent Capital in Chicago. Jack, thank you for joining us today. The market's starting off the week on the right foot after another losing week last week. What is driving this turnaround?
Yeah, I think a little bit of earnings that are in the books and then the prospect of a lot of earnings and economic data this week. So we have a full calendar.
Now, what is going to happen? We have a couple of things happening that may have already happened that are forcing investors to recalibrate their outlook, especially compared to where our heads were at on January 1st. Obviously, 6 interest rate cuts in 2024 is now down to possibly 1, maybe 0. And now the Magnificent 7 is starting to wobble. Maybe we just have a Magnificent 1 or 2 and then a mediocre 5. And how does that change investor expectations going forward?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We had, rate cut expectations were really the catalyst that should have broadened out the market. Because if you think about easier financial conditions, that tends to favor the smaller companies that have maybe a little more debt that aren't quite as profitable as that Magnificent Seven. But even there, you're right, the Magnificent Seven down to Magnificent Two or Three, although today we've got NVIDIA up, over 3%. Yeah, 3.7% today. They've got earnings scheduled later this week.
And then speaking of earnings season, we do have the tech companies reporting this week, and it seems like just overall, if investors don't get the rate cuts that were promised earlier this year, as long as profits exist and productivity improves, they can live with that. And is that a picture being painted by the first quarter results so far?
Yeah, that's it, Rob. You know, generally the S&P strikes its value as a function of two things, earnings and interest rates. Interest rates determine the multiple. The higher the interest rate, the lower the multiple. And, of course, we've seen interest rates go from below 4% in the 10-year earlier this year to now well into over, in fact, 450. So that tends to put a damper on the multiple, but if the earnings come through, and we'll find out more this week, that could offset the higher interest rates.
And yeah, some potential movers later this week. Not just the Bears drafting a new quarterback potentially, Jack, but we're talking about GDP coming out on Thursday, and of course the PCE number, the personal consumption expenditure figure, which is the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, which historically has been cooler than the CPI figures that are released at the beginning of the month.
That's it. A lot of it because it has less reliance on rent and housing costs. In fact, we are going to get some housing data later in the week also. But, you know, that is what the Fed looks at. And if the Fed thinks it's important, I think it's important. So it'll be an important data point later this week.
Jack Ablin, Chief Investment Officer, Crescent Capital in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, how restaurants are feeling the pinch of weight loss drugs.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
A survey by Morgan Stanley finds the people taking weight loss drugs say they're spending less in restaurants and when ordering takeout. We welcome in R.J. Hadavi, head of analytical research at the foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. R.J., thank you for joining us today. Now, for a lot of people who take Ozempic and Wegovy, the transformation they experience is life-changing. On the other hand, if you are in the food business and you have customers making trips less frequently, that is also life-changing. So what is the impact so far of these weight loss drugs on foot traffic at some of the main fast food restaurants in America?
You know, it's a little early with the release of these drugs to make any clear indications or clear correlations with the impact weight loss drugs and having impact at QSR restaurants. Visitation trends are mixed for most QSR chains, and I argue that pricing is probably more of a deterrent than the weight loss drugs at this point. But I do think it is something that restaurant operators across all the different tiers need to be monitoring: QSR, fast casual, full service, fine dining. It could be an impact in the years to come in terms of consumer demand if there's just less of it. Obviously, you need to make some changes to your business, to your point. It could be a life-changing event for a lot of restaurant operators.
It seems like it's not having an impact on the here and now, as you mentioned, and that price is really a bigger determining factor for the average customer if they want to go to a QSR restaurant. But looking down the road, it can add up. That 31.5 million people, Morgan Stanley estimates, are on 9% of the U.S. population, will be on these types of medication by the time we get to the year 2035. So 31.5 million people, all with their appetites being curbed, all skipping trips to certain QSR establishments. But it seems like that also gives them the time to come up with a business plan that would meet these people in the middle.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to think about it, too, is that, you know, in the past, a lot of the QSR operators have tried to introduce healthier fare to widen their audience. But it always hasn't always worked because, honestly, a lot of customers come into QSRs for more indulgent fare. But this could be something more significant. I think over the next, you know, two decades, I think we could start to see more healthier fare introduced to, to the QSR chains to better match what the consumers may be doing in terms of weight loss drugs there as well. So I think this could be something that, as we start to look ahead, could be a major game changer for a lot of QSR and restaurant operators.
We're talking about the impact of weight loss drugs on the quick service restaurant space and on the snack food space with R.J. Hadavi, head of analytical research at the foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. You mentioned quick service restaurants adding salads and more healthy fare to the menu as one way to possibly meet the customer who is now on weight loss medication. But just based on your research, what is a typical fast food customer? Are they going for a meal, or are they going for a snack, or are they going for a meal that they could have on their own and kind of just, as you say, just indulge in some stuff that maybe they don't have all the time?
Well, pre-pandemic, we saw the largest percentage of traffic coming into quick service restaurants were to the lunch day part. Typically, your worker, your employee coming in just to make a quick stop, just looking for something quick. It's interesting, though, as we've kind of moved past the pandemic, we say actually that evening day part, that dinner day part, is really where we've seen more of the traffic shift to. We've seen some other day part shifts, and we've talked about it before with you, Rob, where we've talked about the late morning. You know, instead of going early morning, people working from home, maybe after they drop off their kids in school, come in the late morning or the afternoon, the snacking day part. But for QSRs, it's interesting. We're starting to see more and more dinner day part visits right now, which I think that's something that's going to be a consideration here too as well. It changes who's making the decisions here. Instead of just that individual employee, we see a lot of families coming in. And if, you know, one or two people in the family are on these weight loss drugs, it changes what they may be ordering. So another consideration that operators have to think about here.
It seems like the challenge for the quick service restaurants is not necessarily adding healthier options to the menu. It's trying to find a way to live inside a world in which a lot of customers, if they are on weight loss medication, just don't make that trip at all.
Yeah, and I think there's other ways to do it here too. I mean, I think some of that comes with better communication skills. Some of that changes Again, the assortment, maybe it's not, necessarily healthier thing, but better indulgent, maybe more authentic, product or ingredients going into it. There could be other ways to massage the messaging here, and I think still target some of the people that may be on these drugs.
RJ Hadavi, head of analytical research at the foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. Thank you for joining us today. Join us tomorrow for Travel Tuesday. And still to come, our Monday Stock Picker.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Stock Picker Monday. Lending his expertise today is Tim Grisky, Senior Portfolio Strategist with Ingalls & Snyder in New York. Tim, thank you for joining us today. And you have two selections, and both of them, Tim, coming from the healthcare space.
Yes, good afternoon, Rob. I've decided to focus a bit on healthcare today. The one I'm going to start with is Eli Lilly, which is a pharmaceutical company. People are probably familiar with Jardiance, which is all over television. It's a diabetes 2 drug, but it's being used basically off-label for weight loss. And this is, a very hot area and a area that Lilly is going to do very well in. And they've got a new Alzheimer's drug. They have an interesting cancer drug. This is really a company that where everything is going well.
So Eli Lilly, that is LLY, the pharmaceutical company. And then your next one focuses on the area of medical devices.
Right. Stryker is a medical device company, very diversified across many different areas and has many different uses, including implants used in hip and knee joint replacements. It benefits by being so diverse, and we like that about Stryker. It's also fairly reasonably priced. I'll mention another company in this area, Intuitive Surgical, which is a robotics company. It's an expensive stock, but it is on the cutting edge. And they have a whole new group of products coming out here.
And then just talk about just the growth in the healthcare space overall, especially in the context of the discussion of Eli Lilly and Stryker and Intuitive Surgical. I mean, what is the growth curve for healthcare going forward, especially as we deal with an aging population?
Well, that's exactly the key here, is our population is aging. They are going to need more pharmaceuticals and more joint replacements as time goes on here. So, this is an area that really is very topical.
And it's one of the benefits of living longer is that ironically is that we need more care and maintenance as we get older, because 50 years ago a lot of people passed away at the age of 65 or 70, and if you made it to 80 that was a miraculous. But now as people live into their 80s and 90s, there will be more there's more technology and more technological applications and more companies willing to serve them.
Absolutely. And people can live a better life into their 90s or even into the hundreds. So I think these are companies that are going to be in high demand. Their products are going to be high demand, and we think the securities will as well.
Tim Grisky, Senior Portfolio Strategist, Ingalls & Snyder in New York. Thank you for joining us today. His selections this week on Stock Picker Monday: Eli Lilly, LLY, Stryker, the medical device company, SYK, and Intuitive Surgical, INTU, the ticker symbols today.